Hello and welcome to our quarterly podcast discussing activities to support consistent application. And this podcast covers the third quarter of 2022. I'm Petrina Buchanan, a member of the ISB's technical staff, and I'm here today with Bruce McKenzie, member of the board and chair of the Interpretations Committee. So in today's podcast, we're going to cover the discussions at the September Interpretations Committee meeting. I'm also going to give you an update on the ISB's project on non-current liabilities with covenants. I promised to do that in the last podcast, so we'll cover that today. So let's start with finalised agenda decisions. And there were three discussed by the committee in September. Now, because we talked about these topics earlier in the year, we're just going to focus our discussions today on what respondents said in comment letters and how the committee responded. And in fact, I've just realised there is a bit of a common theme in these three topics, which is that each of them actually cuts across more than one standard. So let's start with lessor accounting, which means looking at IFRS 9 and IFRS 16. So in this fact pattern, a lessor has granted a rent concession that changes the terms and conditions of a lease that the lessor has classified as an operating lease. And the only change to the lease is that the lessor has legally released the lessee from its obligations to make specifically identified lease payments. So in other words, there's actual legal extinguishment of some of the contractual lease payments. And in this fact pattern, the lessor had recognised some of these payments forgiven as income and also as an operating lease receivable because those amounts were already contractually due. And what the committee was asked was about how to apply the expected credit loss or ECL model in IFRS 9 before the rent concession was granted. And then I was also asked how to account for the rent concession at the date it's granted. So lots of comments received on this one, Bruce, and maybe you could explain what those comments were to listeners and what the committee said. And I'll maybe ask you to start with the ECL model.
Sure. Thanks, Petrina. And hello to everybody, and thanks for joining us today. So on the ECL model, some respondents said that the model, in their view, applies only to credit-related cash shortfalls and not necessarily to shortfalls that arise for other reasons. Now, they refer to the words in IFRS 9 that talk about default and credit risk in supporting their reading of these requirements. Now, some also thought that the committee was saying that where a lessor would have to anticipate forgiving lease payments long before it knew whether it would or would not forgive those payments. Now, having considered all the comments, the committee reaffirmed its conclusion that the ECL model in IFRS 9 captures all cash shortfalls. So in other words, we're saying it captures all of the differences between the contractual cash flows and the cash flows the lessor expects to receive, irrespective of the reason for that shortfall. Now, that's how credit losses are defined in IFRS 9. The definition uses the word all. And I mean, this makes sense when you think about it. The principle behind ECL requirements in IFRS 9 is really a simple one, that the entity must not carry its financial asset at more than it expects to receive from those assets. Now, on anticipating forgiving lease payments, the committee clarified that the lessor is not expected to look out into the future and anticipate when it might or might not forgive payments before it's even contemplated doing so. IFRS 9 requires ECL measurement to be based on reasonable and supportable information. So in the agenda decision, the committee is saying that when measuring expected credit losses on an operating lease receivable, a lessor cannot ignore information that it has available to it. In other words, it cannot ignore its own expectations of forgiving lease payments when measuring ECL.
Thanks, Bruce. So if we move on to the accounting for the rent concession, again, a lot of comments on that. And some of the respondents, they disagreed with the committee's conclusion that the derecognition requirements in IFRS 9 apply to forgiven lease payments that are part of an operating lease receivable. Those respondents instead thought that the lease modification requirements in IFRS 16 should be applied to the operating lease receivable, either because they thought those payments could be considered accrued lease payments or because the forgiveness should be considered a lease incentive.
Yeah, no, that's right, Petrina. And I think a lot of those comments arose because people were thinking about fact patterns beyond the narrow one that was submitted. So now in the fact pattern submitted, the only change is the forgiveness that legally releases the lessee from having to make specified lease payments. Now, the more common situation is one for which there are also other changes to the lease contract. Maybe payments are reduced in the short term but increased in the long term, or maybe the lease term is changed, etc. And when there are other changes made to the lease contract, then the lessor would need to look at all of those changes as a package and assess whether the derecognition requirements in IFRS 9 are met or whether all the changes accounted for as a lease modification. So to summarize, the committee confirmed that the derecognition requirements in IFRS 9 apply to operating lease receivables. The lease modification requirements in IFRS 16 apply to modifications that affect lease payments not yet recognized as lease receivables.
Great. Thank you, Bruce. And maybe I'm just going to reiterate again for listeners just how important it is, by the way, to look at the fact pattern. And in this case, the committee's conclusions are very much based on that fact pattern they were asked to look at. So as you note, if the lessee and lessor negotiate other changes at the same time as a concession is granted, then it's really important to look at all of those changes holistically to work out what's going on. Okay, so that's lessor forgiveness of lease payments. I'm going to move on now to SPACs, or Special Purpose Acquisition Companies, and a question that cuts across IAS 32 and IFRS 2. And this is one, again, where in September the committee considered comments and voted to finalise the agenda decision. Now, just a brief reminder of the fact pattern. This is an acquisition where an unlisted entity acquires a listed SPAC. And it does so for two reasons. It, first of all, it wants to acquire the SPAC's cash. And it also, it wants to get the SPAC's stock exchange listing. And to acquire the SPAC, the entity issues new shares and new warrants. And the submitter then asked about how to account for the new warrants. So Bruce, what did respondents say on this one, and how did the committee respond?
So I think the aspect of the tentative agenda decision that raised most comment was the committee's conclusion that the transaction could end up being partly accounted for within the scope of IFRS 2 and partly within the scope of IAS 32. Now, a number of respondents thought it was possible, and would be a lot more straightforward, to account for it all within IFRS 2 or otherwise all of it within IAS 32. So I guess the question is, why did the committee say that you need to account for the split? Well, I think the answer is because that's what the requirements say. I mean, to explain that, remember, IFRS 2 applies to instruments issued to acquire goods and services, whereas IAS 32 applies to instruments issued to acquire cash or other financial assets. So in this transaction, the entity is acquiring cash and a stock exchange listing service. Now, IAS 32 is applied to the instruments issued to acquire the cash, and IFRS 2 to the instruments issued to acquire the stock exchange listing service. Now, very often when instruments are issued, it doesn't matter whether they are in IAS 32 or IFRS 2, because regardless, the classification will be the same. In other words, they'll either be liabilities or equity under both standards. But in this fact pattern, the standard matters for the warrants, because if they're in IAS 32, the warrants will be accounted for as liabilities, whereas if they're in IFRS 2, then they would be accounted for as equity. Now, these kind of SPAC transactions are quite niche, and they hit the headlines over the past few years, but have declined in popularity more recently. And each transaction is likely to be structured slightly differently. So it's important to look closely at exactly what the specific facts and circumstances are, how the transaction has been structured, and what are the various terms and conditions. Now, this agenda decision does a great job in analysing the transaction step by step to work out what requirements apply and how to apply them.
Great. Thanks a lot, Bruce. So moving swiftly on to the next finalised agenda decision, and the two standards in question this time are IFRS 17 and IAS 21. And IFRS 17 actually is a standard that's really become a regular guest, I think, on our podcast in 2022. And in this case, the specific questions asked were about multi-currency insurance contracts. So the first question asked whether an insurer considers currency risk when identifying portfolios of insurance contracts. And in response to that, the committee said, yes, an entity is required to consider all risks, including currency risk, when identifying portfolios of insurance contracts. But an entity could identify portfolios that include contracts subject to different currency risks. So in that question, almost all respondents agreed with the committee's analysis. Now, the second question asked about how an insurer measures a group of insurance contracts with cash flows in more than one currency. And in this question, the committee said a number of things. So it said that an entity needs to apply the measurement requirements in IFRS 17, and it also, of course, needs to apply the applicable requirements in IAS 21. And in order to do that, it would need to determine the currency denomination of the group of insurance contracts. And depending on the circumstances, it could actually determine that the currency of the group is a single currency, or it could determine that the currency of the group is the multiple currencies of the cash flows in the group. So respondents to this tentative agenda decision raised various questions about how exactly the insurer would apply the measurement requirements in IFRS 17 when multiple currencies are involved. And in response to that, the committee added, I think, some helpful explanation to the agenda decision. So for me, I'm just going to highlight the couple of additions that I think are particularly helpful. So first of all, the agenda decision now explains that the currency denomination of the group will determine which effects of exchange rate changes are treated as changes in financial risk in IFRS 17, and which of those effects are treated as exchange differences in IAS 21. So for example, this means that if the currency of the group is the multiple currencies of the cash flows, then all exchange rate changes are exchange differences accounted for applying IAS 21. Whereas if the currency of the group is a single currency, then part of the exchange rate changes are exchange differences in IAS 21, and part are changes in financial risk accounted for in IFRS 17. Another addition to the agenda decision actually clarifies that the CSM, the contractual service margin, can never be negative. And of course, that's because the CSM is defined in IFRS 17 as representing the unearned profit in the group. So that's the three agenda decisions the committee voted to finalise in September. Now, those agenda decisions are still draft at the moment. They will be discussed by the board in October. And if the board doesn't object to the agenda decisions, then all three will be published later in October. So if I move on now to the ISB's work in supporting consistent application, and I think it's probably useful to tell you a bit about the forthcoming narrow scope amendments to IAS 1 that actually you can expect to see issued very soon, so within the next month or so. And those amendments are to the requirements in IAS 1 on current, non-current classification of liabilities. In this case, it's specifically about non-current liabilities with covenants. So as a quick reminder, the board decided to develop these narrow scope amendments, ultimately, of course, to improve financial reporting. And in this case, at the same time, it was responding to concerns raised by stakeholders about amendments to the current non-current requirements in IAS 1 issued in 2020. So Bruce, what can listeners expect to see in these amendments when they're issued?
So these amendments really do two things. Firstly, they clarify how an entity needs to think about covenants when classifying liabilities arising from loan arrangements. And secondly, for liabilities classified as non-current, they require disclosure by covenants to be met within 12 months after the reporting date. So on classification, the amendments will make it clear that an entity considers only covenants required to be met on or before the reporting date. So if an entity is not in breach of any covenants at its reporting date, and assuming the loan is not repayable within 12 months, then it will classify the loan as non-current, even if it has to meet other covenants within 12 months after the reporting date. Now, the amendments will also require new disclosures about covenants, which is, investors are telling us are really important for the information that they get. And in finalizing the amendments, in response to feedback, we've refined those disclosure requirements to make them easier for entities to apply. So for non-current liabilities with covenants to be met within 12 months, entities will be required to disclose the following information: the covenants and the carrying amount of the related liabilities, and any facts and circumstances that indicate the entity may have difficulty complying with those covenants. So now those amendments are expected to be issued by the end of October and are effective from 1st of January 2024. Now, importantly, the effective date of the 2020 amendments to IAS 1 has also been moved to 1 January 2024.
Great. Thank you, Bruce. So that's it for this quarter. That brings our podcast to a close. Thanks a lot, Bruce, for joining me today. And even more thanks to all of you for listening to our podcast. Please email communications@ifrs.org if you have any suggestions for how we can improve it. So take care. Thank you and goodbye.